Man, this is why I love public radio stations, you know, because I grew up in a public radio station. I was hired 30 years ago last month. It was like 30 years ago on February 24th of 1986. It's terrifying. That's when I first walked in the door of radio station WDET, the Detroit Public Radio Station, the great public radio station. And little did I know that, A, where it would lead and what adventures it would lead to. But I was NPR's Detroit Bureau for 14 years. I started out at the station and started freelancing for NPR right away. And it was a few years before NPR, NPR kept giving me assignments elsewhere in the country as a freelancer. And I kept saying, you know, I kind of have this job here in Detroit that I kind of have to do. And finally, at one point, and I want to say, it might have been the flood story. No, I think I was already on staff by then. But anyway, finally, at one point, they said, just come and work for us. So I was an employee of NPR at that point, and I could have set up a little home office. I lived in Royal Oak, Michigan. It was an 11-mile commute to the station, you know, kind of rush hour, all that, not a bad commute. And then after a few years, we moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan, which was a 40-mile commute downtown. And I certainly could have set up a little home office in Ann Arbor and just kind of done my work from there. And every day for those 14 years, I commuted into Detroit. Not just because I liked Detroit. I liked Detroit. I love Detroit. But I liked working in a station. You know, it's like, and I liked that environment. And I liked the energy of it. And I liked the fact that, you know, you'd look and somebody'd be walking down the hall and you'd say, who is that? Who's that guy with those crazy clothes on? And they go, oh, that's Dr. John. He's in town and he's doing an interview, you know? Or it'd be Mose Allison. And you guys, you know, you probably get people from the Bix and all that kind of stuff. And the monarch butterflies, you know, and the figgy. And I just love it. And I had the distinct pleasure of being interviewed today by Don Wooten. And we had a very nice chat, and I guess it's on Saturday or someplace. So I'm a guy who loves public radio stations, even though I've worked at the headquarters in NPR for a long time. And that picture of me on the table, it's a fine picture. In fact, I probably haven't looked that good in a little bit. But I was at the station today, and where's Michelle? Michelle's back there. So Michelle has like another version of this promo card. And you know what it is? It's a picture of me taken on my Ragbri ride like 3 years ago, right? So it's the exact same thing, but it's a picture of me, same glasses, same short gray hair, and I'm holding up the biggest pork chop you've ever seen in your life from Mr. Pork Chop, if you guys know Ragbri and Mr. Pork Chop. And I said to her, I said, that day was like one of the best days of my life. And I don't think this day that this picture captures, I mean, maybe it wasn't a bad day, but it wasn't as good as that day on Ragbri riding across Iowa and eating Mr. Pork Chop's food. So everybody says to me, boy, isn't this a different year? You know, isn't this, have you ever seen anything like this? Is this the craziest campaign ever? So here's my answer. This is my fifth full-time presidential campaign. And before that, I had a piece of NPR's coverage when I was still in Detroit of the 1996 Clinton-Dole race and the 1992 Clinton-Bush Ross Perot race. He was still in the mix. And I even went to a rally at Hart Plaza in downtown Detroit in 1988 on Labor Day, where candidate Mike Dukakis was there. And you know what I remember about that day? Aretha Franklin saying, you know? So these are the little perks. These are the little perks of the job. But anyway, so let's just count the five that I've covered full time. Again, starting with the premise that this is the weirdest one ever. Well, there was that little race in 2000 between Bush and Gore where I knew that at the end of that race, that was when I was going to, on election day, that was when I was going to start my tenure as NPR's White House correspondent. So I was all set to start covering the transition and going to, you know, the winning candidate's state, and it was either going to be Tennessee, or with Gore, it would have been coming to Washington, or it was going to be to Texas to start covering the transition and all that. And the next thing I know, after like 3 days of no sleep after Election Day, I find myself in West Palm in Florida, and I'm peering into the windows, and people are hanging, holding ballots up to the light. You know, looking for hanging chads. You still know that term, right? You still know what a hanging chad is. We didn't know before that, but it's part of our lexicon now. And you know, that was kind of a different presidential campaign. It was pretty crazy, and it took like 44 days or whatever. And you know, I'm standing outside the state house in Texas the day the Supreme Court declared George W. Bush the winner. And he gave his acceptance speech, if you recall, in the chamber of the Texas legislature, because he was staking it out, and Gore gave his speech, and I was live on All Things Considered, kind of from outside, where there were protesters, as you can imagine, and there were people happy, as you can imagine, and there were arguments between the protesters and the people who were happy, and that was like just a hugely crazy day. But it was also, as a reporter, there was like, well, at least we now know, and at least I know who I'm going to be covering for the next 4 years, or as long as I'm NPR White House correspondent. I thought it would only be 2 or 4 years at that point. It ended up being 10, but that's probably another story. But it was, so there was that election. 2004 was kind of boring by comparison, except that the Iraq War was the whole backdrop for that campaign, and kind of the run-up to war, and, you know, the degree how Bush sold the war, and the war by then was already starting to not go really great. But that was by most accounts kind of a normal campaign, even though they were big monumental issues that were being argued. But you may recall during the day, you know, we always get those exit polls, which are surveys of actual voters as they're leaving their polling place, right? So we got election poll or exit polls, and we usually start getting them at about 4 PM, and we never report on them, because you don't report on how people voted, or how, you know, you don't report on broad election trends and actual results until the polls have closed. That's just the way we do things, and it's pretty much accepted practice now. But those exit polls had John Kerry winning. They had John Kerry winning, and Bush, and more to the point, Karl Rove, was despondent, right? And it showed them losing Ohio. And he made a stop. He decided to make a stop on his way from Texas, Crawford, Texas, where he voted, flying back to Washington. They made a stop and did an Election Day campaign event in Ohio. And polls closed. And suddenly it's, you know, 10 o'clock at night, we don't have a winner in Ohio. And Ohio is going to be the difference. Florida the time before, but Ohio this time. Suddenly it's midnight, we don't have a winner. Suddenly it's 2 AM, we don't have a winner. And suddenly we're all like thinking, here we go again. You know, it's deja vu all over again, to quote the great Yogi Berra. And we didn't find out till the following morning. So even that one was kind of crazy, but it snuck up on us. It snuck up on us. Now, let's fast forward 4 more years, that epic battle, and it was a really epic battle between Senator Barack Obama and Senator Hillary Clinton for the Democratic nomination. And that one was normal in no way at all. It was, I mean, that was a really kind of a historic battle. Never before had we had the two major candidates for the Democratic, not for any nomination, an African-American and a woman. And I remember talking to voters in Wisconsin that year, just before the Wisconsin primary. And Wisconsin's one of those places, if you're a Democratic voter, lot of working class Democrats in a place like Wisconsin, and we'd go to like bowling alleys in Kenosha and places like that to talk to voters. And kind of the conversation we were having with those voters, these white working class Democrats, is, you know, for the first time in your life, there's nobody who looks like you on the ballot. And kind of what do you make of that? And you can imagine that led to some interesting conversations, you know? And then obviously the history of Obama not just securing the nomination. First the history of him winning the Iowa caucuses, then winning the nomination, and then winning the presidency. Winning the presidency was actually because of the economic crisis and everything else. It was almost an anticlimax because it just became a blowout at the end. And after the economic crash, you pretty much knew where this was going, and the polls indicated all that and everything else. But then when we got to the election day in Grant Park, obviously, you know, it was hard not to, you know, just stop and kind of take in that moment in American history. So there's just another kind of normal, you know, election. Obama's re-election was pretty routine, which brings us to this year. But here, I do still think this year deserves its own special category. I do, and here's why. And that's not to diminish the unusual nature of those other ones or the historic nature of them, you know, and each in its own way. But again, when you do this for a while, you know, you get experience. You learn some things, you gain knowledge, you know, you learn a few moves, you become, as your hair gets gray, kind of a senior presence on the campaign trail. And maybe younger reporters, you know, turn to you for wisdom. I actually had a young reporter say this to me during the 2012 campaign. They said, "You really covered the 2000 recount?" You know, and I was kind of like, that was kind of like yesterday. You know, that wasn't. Anyway, so even in those kind of, you know, unusual years, when something would happen, you could still say, well, I've kind of seen this before, and you could like anticipate how it might play out. And it's not that you're predicting how it would play out, and it's not like you're going on the air with how you think it's going to play out. You still wait for it to happen. But you could anticipate things based on the past and based on how elections have always gone, you know, kind of in the modern era, at least for decades. And I feel like I stand before you today as a guy, you know, proud of his 30 years experience, his 30-year anniversary at National Public Radio, and somebody who's covered 5 elections full time and has learned a few things over the years, and tell you I am just an utter imposter standing here, because I have been wrong every single time. Maybe it hasn't been every single time, but I've been wrong. Like, you know, each time I kind of thought, oh, this happened, now I know how this is gonna go, and it doesn't. And I mean, you guys follow politics, you've been in the same boat, right? You've been in the exact same boat. So here's what I'd like to do. I should keep an eye on my watch. Somebody's got to tell me when I got to stop. I want to look at 3 particular dates on the campaign that each was meaningful in its own way. Not that they were monumental, but each was meaningful in its own way, and each one kind of told me the opposite of what I thought was going to happen. Okay. So the first one was the very first day of the 2016 campaign. There's no official start, but we'll call this the unofficial start of the 2016 campaign. And it was January 24th of 2015. That's how long I've been at this for this year, by the way. I was hoping I would win those earrings. Because, like, my wife sees my hotel statements, and it says, "Oh, congratulations, 51 nights on the road already this year." So it would have helped to be able to take those home after this trip. But anyway, I'll go buy some. I'll get some. maybe turquoise instead of the, you know. So it was January 24th of last year. And Congressman Steve King was at the Hoyt Sherman Theater, beautiful old theater in downtown Des Moines, restored, all that. And he was having what we kind of affectionately, no disrespect to anybody intended, but we affectionately call a cattle call, right? A campaign cattle call. It was the first one. And here's what happened that day. We had Walker, we had Trump, we had Cruz, we had Fiorina, we had Carson. I'm actually kind of working from a list. We had Christie, we had Huckabee, we had Santorum, we had Bobby Jindal, we had Sarah Palin, we had John Bolton, the former ambassador to the UN, and I'm pretty sure there were others that I'm forgetting. We did not have Jeb Bush. You know what? Jeb was the front runner, and Jeb Bush didn't need to be associating himself with that congressman from Northwest Iowa, Stephen King, because Jeb's an establishment guy, and we all know King is very much not that, right? So he didn't come, and Rubio didn't come. And there were also rumblings then that Romney might get into the race, and Romney didn't come either. But it was a seriously big cattle call, and we were in the cramped balcony. They had all the press in the balcony, looking down on the scene, and it started at like 8 a.m., or at least I was in my seat by 8 a.m., and it ended sometime after 6 p.m., just like one speech after another. And here's what I knew after that speech. First, I knew that Scott Walker was a serious candidate. Because Scott Walker, he was coming off the successful recall, right? And re-election, and so he'd won statewide election in Wisconsin 3 times in 4 years, unprecedented. And guess what? That's a state the Democrats always carry in the presidential elections. And guess what? He spent time when he was like a toddler for a few years in Iowa, so he could claim Iowa roots. And guess what? His dad was a Baptist minister, so that was going to get him, in good stead with the evangelical vote. And, he took on the unions and won. So he suddenly had a great resume, but the rap on Walker was always, yeah, but how will he play on a national stage? And he blew the roof off the place on that day. He was in his shirt sleeves. He was like prowling back and forth on the stage. And he was by far the standout hit. He immediately started going up in the polls. And I said on All Things Considered that night, this was Scott Walker's day, and he made himself a serious presence in this campaign on that day. So there was that. I'm going to read what I said about Donald Trump that day. And I will tell you that, Trump came through, and I knew Donald Trump wasn't going to be a candidate. He always did this. And he was passing out postcards, and, he was working the room, and he was schmoozing. And I was pretty determined not to use Donald Trump in my story. I ended up using him in my story because he gave me a perfect piece of tape that allowed me to like make a turn in my script, right? And it was like I was kind of talking about Jeb Bush not being there, and I needed to get from this part of the script to that part of the script. And Donald Trump said, "Here's my line leading up to it." Donald Trump was on the bill. Few believe he means it when he says he's thinking again about running. He called out Mitt Romney and Jeb Bush, neither of whom attended the event. Trump said Romney had his chance and choked. As for Bush, then we heard tape of Trump, the last thing we need is another Bush. He was the only one who said something like that, and I kind of needed that in my story, so I put Trump in my story. I don't think I used him in another story for many months. I mean, I probably mentioned him, but I didn't go to any of his events. I didn't, he didn't declare until July. Maybe it was June. Don't hold me. Anyway, he didn't declare till the summer. So we were still kind of like skeptical that he was going to release his forms and everything else. So very confident at the end of that day that Trump was just doing his usual drill. Guess what? And then the other thing I got wrong that day was that I did think it was like a good thing that Jeff was there, because he didn't need to be in the middle of this. He was the front runner. He didn't have to. It's like, so here we are. So now let's jump forward to Iowa again, July 18th, summertime. Scott Walker was campaigning a lot, but he wasn't officially a candidate until the summertime. He had a lot of stuff to do with the legislature back home, the budget and other things. So he couldn't declare while he was in the middle of all that stuff, because it was just going to get messy and complicated. So he waited till all the legislative business was done. He declared, And this weekend in July was probably a week after he had declared. It was his first, it was like his big Iowa kickoff weekend. And he started out at the ballpark here in Davenport. Was anybody there? Anybody remember that? It was his first event, and he had a Winnebago, of course. He was smart enough to get a Winnebago and not, you know, not some other kind of generic brand bus. And he was gonna tour all over the state from east to west. And on that first 2 days, we went from Davenport, and then I think we did an event right next to the museum in, it might have been Waterloo. Then we went to Urbandale, I think, and then Council Bluffs the next morning, and then Sioux City, I think it was. Might have been Lamar's, but I think it was Sioux City. So, and he had a lot of press following him, and he was drawing okay crowds. He wasn't doing like big blockbuster events. He was more that personal meet and greet, but he was going everywhere. And it was his big kickoff, and it was on the weekend, and he fully expected, and his campaign fully expected, that Monday morning, all the stories would be about Scott Walker and his, you know, here he goes. This is it. It's begun, and he's going to capitalize on all of those things I talked about earlier. So here's what happened. I went to that first day on Friday. On Saturday, we were in Sioux City. And while we're at the Sioux City event, word broke that something had happened at a family leader event. That's, you guys know the family leader, the evangelical group in Iowa. They were hosting a big day-long forum at the auditorium in Ames at Iowa State. And Donald Trump was there. And he said that John McCain is not a war hero. He likes guys who don't get captured, right? And I can't remember what his exact language was, but the word loser was used somewhere in there. And we're hearing about this while we're with Scott Walker. So Scott Walker is scheduled to speak at this same event later in the evening, but now it's, you know, early afternoon. And we're a couple of hours away. But immediately, I and a lot of others, we thought, well, we're going to Ames with Walker anyway. We might as well skip his next two events and just go straight there. So the press corps for Walker suddenly shrunk, right? But driving to Ames, I'm having conversations with my editor, and we're saying, this is what we've been waiting for from Trump. He's gone too far. This is the beginning of the Trump fall. Yep. And he wasn't leading the polls yet. And you guys all remember that moment, right? But guess what? Within 2 weeks, he had moved into the lead. He like spiked upward and has never relinquished that lead except for the briefest of moments when Ben Carson was in first place in the Real Clear Politics polling averages, national polling averages. Wrong again, Don. You know? So now let's fast forward a few more months. The bombing happens in Paris. And here we are on a day when we're still kind of dealing with the aftermath of Brussels, and we've had San Bernardino, of course. And the conventional wisdom is this is when voters are going to get serious, because this makes it very tangible and scary. And this is when they'll start looking for a sure hand, a cool head, everything else. Trump, maybe after San Bernardino, calls for his ban on Muslims coming into the US. You know, this is after he'd already used his kickoff announcement to talk about rapists coming in from across the border from Mexico. And again, it seemed like, okay, this is another moment. It'll be a moment of reckoning for Trump. Up go the polls. Up go the polls. So wrong again. I was in good company. But at that point, I wasn't surprised at being wrong, because I like knew my track record was already pretty shaky. And by then, the story was, what will it take? Why are these other candidates, many of them well-funded, many of them skilled campaigners and skilled politicians and people with pretty impressive resumes, why are they just unable to do it? And then we kind of go into the world where Trump is taking on Megyn Kelly in that first debate, and the, you know, and I don't need to repeat it all, but that's now kind of renewed itself and is happening again. So in that regard, it's and obviously I'm like just picking, you know, three dates, and there have been a couple hundred pretty fascinating dates. But those are like three dates that were really, really telling. And the other thing, and I'll wrap up the Republicans here, and I'm talking more about the Republicans because that's who I'm covering mostly. I've been out with Clinton and Sanders just a very little bit. I'm almost exclusively covering the Republicans. But recall that when Mitt Romney lost, the Republicans engaged in some very deep soul searching, the party. And they produced a document less than a year after that election, in fact, just months after that election, called a Growth and Opportunity Report. It's how the party can grow, how it can learn the mistakes, learn from the mistakes of this campaign when they thought they should have beaten Obama, and how they can grow in this changing America, where the demographics were kind of working against the Republicans and a lot of social attitudes, particularly on same-sex marriage and things like that, and where young people are in that, was going the wrong way, and even feelings about immigration reform were going the wrong way. So they came up with this very sober document with this list of recommendations for what the party needed to do, which is speak more inclusively about Latinos, figure out a way to get immigration reform passed. We don't have to change our stand on same-sex marriage, but we need to talk about it in a different way so we're not alienating young voters. And it was item after item after item on that. And what we've seen this campaign is that everything that the party hoped for, the dialogue and the debate has gone the other way. And the things, like two of the things that got Romney in trouble, there was the 47% remark, that videotaped remark about the takers, the makers versus the takers in the country. And there was that line in his debate that kept getting pointed to, talking about people in the country illegally, self-deportation. And that was kind of ruled as, yeah, we shouldn't be saying stuff like that. And you compare that to kind of where the discussion is now. So the party is not where the RNC hoped it would be in terms of positioning itself to do well for the future. But these are also Republican voters who have been rewarding the outsiders in the race, Trump and Cruz, both of whom are very serious outsiders and are kind of shaking things up. So that is one of the fascinating stories that we're going to be watching going forward, even beyond this election, what the Republican Party looks like, if the party has room for all of these various factions, movements, call it what you will, within the party. And that is endlessly fascinating. That is really fascinating. And the party is wrestling with some very big and from some serious questions. Now, I'm going to talk about this briefly again, because I haven't been on it that much. The Democrats have been plenty interesting too. You know, I mean, it's been a different kind of interesting. The debate between, you know, Sanders and Clinton has not taken on kind of the vicious tone that we've seen and some of the, you know, the insults and everything else that we've seen on the Republican side. But my instincts failed me there as well. I mean, not that I thought Senator Clinton or Secretary Clinton was going to have a coronation. I thought there was certainly a potential because of history and because of, you know, questions that certainly the emails, but other things that might not make it, you know, a walk in the park for her to get to the nomination. But the notion that this Democratic, socialist, independent senator from Vermont by way of Brooklyn has been drawing the crowds and has really captured the energy of the Obama campaign, 2008, with the young people and the crowds and the excitement, has also been just hugely, hugely unexpected. So we should. Do we have time for some questions? Are we? So let me just kind of say to wrap up. If you kind of want a prediction, because more than one person has asked me for that. So my prediction is, as I do this, more head scratching, more moments of me being utterly wrong, and my experience kind of serving me very poorly in these moments. But just, you know, still trying to capture the moment and capture the vibe and capture the story. And you know, obviously the most likely contest at this point, and I'm not saying it is going to be this, but the most likely contest at this point is, you know, Clinton's got a significant edge and Trump has a significant edge, but we don't know if we're going to have an open convention, a contested convention, and what that's going to mean. And there's just a lot of things going to happen yet. So if you want a prediction from me, I guess the only thing I would say is I'm the guy who has Michigan State University, my alma mater, winning the basketball tournament this year. And, you know, there's no way those guys from Middle Tennessee State University are going to knock us off in the first round because we're going to win the title. So that's my word of caution. I didn't put any money on that, and I'm not putting any money on the election. So thank you.